Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
I really liked what you said about the mirror yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Comparing the different metaphors, reflecting versus pervading. And it wasn't really any of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of had a sense that, I don't know, but it sort of grabbed my attention then. But it's almost as though, the mitya is another metaphor, sort of a mitya was sort of inside of it, inside of being, so to speak. And it occurred to me that, that makes sense, that it's a mystery that it seems like within mitya we can know or talk about being. And then it occurred to me, that must be because the mitya is unreal. It made more sense to me when I said it.
No, go on.
Yesterday. But it's because the mitya, because the form was... was within the being, and the being was the substance of it, and was the only thing that was real. And when the being within the form said, "I am," it was really just the substance that was not saying "I am," but was awareness, was self-evident awareness of itself. But that there could be appear to be substance to the mitya.
Yes.
Yeah.
The mitya, that whatever is mitya, kind of owns the substance. Substance is belonging to itself, and so it takes on. It believes that it is the conscious being, and the conscious being takes on all the attributes of the mitya, whatever that happens to be. There's no separation between the two, but one is mitya, the other is satyam.
I have a kind of mechanical question. What is the relationship of the senses to the four types of vritti?
Oh. What they usually say is that when you divide the antakarna, the mind, into these four categories, the perceptions just come into the manas. So the five sense organs have to come into one container where all five are experienced together. Because each sense organ experiences its sense object alone, not together. Right? So then you have five, but now when we're using all five sense organs, right, we're experiencing it together to make one image. And that image is what we call a vritti that takes place in the mind. Right, so the mind has to be made up of the sattva aspect of all five sense organs. Well, the sattva aspect of all five elements together make up the mind, where the sattva aspect of each element individually makes up a sense organs, one sense organ. And so when these sense organs have to come into the vritti, which is made of all five, the sattva of all five elements, and then the whole is experienced. But then if we look at it in terms of the four categories of the antakarana of the mind, it's the manas that is receiving, that's the vritti is the manas, and then the buddhi responds to the manas. The ahankara, the vritti is, sometimes the ahankara is put in with the buddhi, because it's a decisive knowledge. At other times it's kept separate. But the buddhi itself is knowledge. It's more subtle than the manas. The manas is just taking the perception. And then the buddhi is what relates to the perception. The ahankara also relates to the perception. You know, you have a sad vritti, and that's the manas. The ahankara comes and says, "I am sad." The buddhi says something about the sadness, you know. Don't worry, it's only a vritti. The jnana, he says, don't worry. Mm-hmm. Nothing's happening to you. It's only good to relax. It's mm-hmm. okay. Whatever. Does that help?
Yeah.
I have kind of a follow-up question to that. Like, I think you were saying the Buddha needs to recognize...
It's on mityatva.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. So, like, it backs up. And then how does that... How... And then it becomes an object to itself, or somehow where it finally becomes objectified or something?
Well, it's just to kind of simplify it. Say if you have a vritti, a thought modification. Mm-hmm. The question is that thought modification known to you?
Yeah.
And you have to say, yes, it's known.
Yeah.
That means you have a subject-object relationship with the vritti.
Yeah.
Okay, then you can say... Then you can notice, when the vritti goes, do you go with it? And you say, no, I don't go with it. So you're not a traveler. The vritti's a traveler. The vritti's come into being and go, thought modifications come into being and go out of being. When they're there, they enjoy your consciousness. The consciousness that they have is the consciousness that is you. The existence they have is the chit, sat chit. Mm-hmm. Then the vritti goes and now it no longer has any being at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the vritti is continually changing, the vrittis are coming and going, these thought modifications are coming and going,
mm-hmm.
but the atma remains the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something that you can recognize. It's just a fact to be seen, to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
When you recognize that every vritti is known, and you're also aware of the changes that are kind of going on in the vrittis, then there's no way that you can be the vritti. There's a little logic called anvaya vyatireka. The anvaya is a positive relation between two things, and the vyatireka is a negative relation. So a proper anvaya vyatireka goes, the anvaya would be like when the sun is, the day is. In English, you just say, you know, when the sun is shining, the day, you know, it's day. So, but just to follow the structure, when the sun is, the day is. When the sun is not, the day is not. So that means that there's a direct relationship between sun and day, because there's a positive correlation and a negative. But if you don't have both the positive correlation and the negative correlation, then there's no real relationship. Like, what if I were to say, when the thought is, I am. When the thought is not, I am not. That's a full anvaya vyatireka. There would definitely be a relationship between the thought and me, right? When the thought is, I am. When the thought is not, I am not. But what about when you say, when the thought is, I am. When the thought is not, I still am. When the sadness is, I am. When the sadness is not, I am not. Then I would be sad, you know. I am the sadness. But what about when the sadness is, I am. When the sadness is not, I still am.
Mm-hmm.
When there's no negative correlation, then there's no relationship. The two are appearing together, but there's a superimposition that makes you take one to be the other. But when the one side of the superimposition remains, when the other side, as the side, leaves, then that can't be you.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be. And so that anvaya vyatireka we use as a prakriya, as a teaching methodology in different mm-hmm. in different circumstances.
So the thought modifications, I'm interpreting or understanding it as part of the manas or the mind.
Yep.
Is that right?
The thought modifications?
Yeah,
it depends. The modifications could be the buddhi. But
okay.
But if it depends on the type of thought modification. When the ahankara is, I am. When the ahankara is not, I still am. Ah, I'm not
uh-huh.
the ahankara.
Uh-huh.
You know? So it could be when the memory is, when the chitta is, I am. When the chitta is not, means memory. When the memory is, I am. When the chitta, when the memory is not, I still am. So it's, you can do it with anything, actually.
So now, I think that's my confusion, is sussing out what is the buddhi as opposed to the mind and rest, because it sounded like you can back up and do that seer seeing, you know, everything, and then you get to like the buddhi, and that's even more subtle.
Subtle, but it's still known.
Okay, and then so what would its characteristics be if it's known? How do I know that I'm knowing I've backed up sort of behind the body,
well,
so to
speak? Well, because when we talk about the antakarana as the mind, we say the mind has four categories. Mm-hmm. All of those categories, all of them are known. Like I use the example, or and Swamiji's used this example too, of somebody forgetting their key. So you walk halfway down the steps. Did I forget my keys? Where are my keys? You know? You look all around. Where did I leave my keys? You know? And so you can't really do anything until you figure that out. What are you going to do? You say, okay, I have no idea where my keys are. Where should I start to look? Okay, or something like that. You know? Or the better one is you get halfway down the steps and then you go, did I lock the door? You know? Then you can't remember. Did I lock the door? Then the Buddha comes in and says, because you're, no, I locked the door. That's manas. You know? I don't know. Did I? Did I not? Did I? That's manas. The Buddha comes in and it says, you don't know whether you locked the door or not. Please go check. Or the Buddha says, yeah, I clearly remember I locked the door. Okay, we can go. Then you remember, you know? Mm-hmm. That's a type of thought that's determinative. It's not vague.
Yeah.
So the manas is, one type of manas is just indecisive thinking.
Yeah.
The Buddha is direct, it's clarity. Where there's knowledge there, there's clarity there. That's those type of vrittis. There's another type of vritti is the ahankara. Like, I'm going to do this. That means the I is now associated really with the one who's with whatever part of the upadis are doing something. I am doing this. Or I am looking at that. Or I am listening to the music. Those are all the different types of ahankara where the I is superimposed upon something which I'm actually aware of, which is an instrument of action or an instrument of perception or the mind itself. Right, all of these are known. Like, say, if you say, "I am going to the store," this is a simple sentence. Is that sentence known?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's known. It's determined to be. I am going to the store. That's the Buddha. Really, it's made a decision. Mm-hmm. You know, should I go to the store? Should I not go to the store? Maybe I should go to the store tomorrow. I could go this afternoon. That's the manas. You know, there's just, I don't know. It just mind's just going, that's manas. Also, negative emotions are manas. Yeah. They rise from the unconscious and they're just there to be responded to. Or to over, the manas also, in terms of emotions, can, because this is how emotions work, they overwhelm the antakarana. They overwhelm the vritti. So the vritti becomes pervaded by the emotion. The antakarana becomes pervaded by the emotion. And then the buddhi, two basic things can happen to the buddhi. The buddhi can differentiate itself from the manas and comment on it or be a healer in reference to it, you know. Or the buddhi also can itself be overwhelmed by the manas and then be talking from the standpoint of the manas. It's like the manas is as though the self. The manas becomes between the self and the buddhi. So because the buddhi has been overwhelmed, the vritti has been overwhelmed by depression, say, or by sadness, you know. And then all of the decisions and activities of the buddhi are backed by that sad emotion, right? So, with self-knowledge, we actually learn how to differentiate the buddhi from the emotion, even if it's overwhelmed. Even if the buddhi can say, "You're feeling so sad," that immediately releases the buddhi, because you've created a subject-object relationship, you become aware of the sadness, that very act of becoming aware of the sadness, then you might say, you feel so sad, tell me about it. There's a subject-object relationship that can be generated there that is very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. But if you don't know how to do that, then when, say, the sadness or the depression, whatever overwhelming emotion is there, then all of the thoughts can come out of that sadness. Mm-hmm. Even your determinative thinking, you know, you can, the ahankara, I'm really sad. And that's ahankara. I'm totally identified with myself as being sad, you know, or feeling sad, I make decisions out of the sadness. I make conclusions. I conclude things, you know, from the standpoint of the sadness. Rather than objectifying the sadness and coming into relationship with the sadness from my own swarupa, from my own nature, I'm speaking from the sadness. So it's really important, or very, very, very useful to be able to differentiate for the buddhi to differentiate the sadness from itself, and then be a spokesperson for the atma, for your own swarupa, once that's known. Mm-hmm.
But it itself can then be objectified.
Yes, because the one who's speaking,
it's a class of thought. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah.
Certain clarity, determinative thought. It itself is a class of conceptualization or something.
Yes, it is. Where there's a decisive knowledge that you can act upon.
Yeah.
Those type of thoughts are the buddhi.
Yeah. Because when I've heard you talk about it before, it had like this privileged glow around it. And I was, this buddhi sounds cool. You know?
Well, it doesn't have, it's not privileged, but it's privileged in a way, because that's the type of vritti where knowledge is stored, even relative knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's an expert. The buddhi is an expression of that, of clarity, where the manas is an expression of non-clarity, of doubt. You know, but the buddhi also, for jnani, somebody who has self-knowledge, that self-knowledge is the buddhi. The buddhi is the one that has the self-knowledge, not the fluctuating manas.
Why it's important.
Yeah, that's why it's important. It's, as Bush would say, it's the decider. You remember that? The decider?
Yeah, Bush too.
Yeah, the decider. The buddhi is the decider.
I always associated buddhi with, like, the Buddha, and it was an exalted place.
Well, it is exalted in the sense that it is innermost to all of the different types of vrittis.
Yeah.
It can objectify all the different vrittis and comment on them, mm-hmm. you know, come into relationship with them, you know, where there's kind of consciousness involved there. Where the manas is, there's consciousness involved because it reflects the situation, but there's no commentator.
And then when does the buddhi become an object?
It's objectified as soon as you realize that you're aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
You're aware of its activity.
And you're aware of its...
But you know what the thing is? You are always aware of it. That's just, you may not ever think about it, that's all. You don't realize that there's a subject-object relationship there. It doesn't occur to you as being important or how it fits into the scheme of things, that fact.
So the inner friend speaks from the buddhi and in a clarity, not so much from the manas that's sort of syrupy, nicey.
Well, the manas, I would say... The manas is the one the buddhi is speaking to, say the unconscious. The manas rises into the unconscious if you address it. You know, so the buddhi is speaking to the manas in the form of an inner child. Like the buddhi, well, let me make it more clear. The complexes, or that we can call in psychology, we call them the inner children, the little ones inside that have this or that hurt. They're not necessarily available for you to go and come into relationship with immediately. So the buddhi can say, you know, does anyone inside, I use this one, so does anyone inside have anything to say? And they hear that, and then they will comment. But when they comment, they're coming in there. There can also be affect and feeling there. And then they'll say what they want to say. Sometimes when you first start this, people have said, when I ask that question, all kinds of little ones raise their hand. You know? There's a lot of stuff in there that would love to come into relationship, come into consciousness and received as, by an inner friend. By somebody, inner friend means somebody who is not threatening, but somebody who is loving, like a good mother or a good guru or a good something, you know, good therapist or good parent. Somebody who loves it. Mm. You know? And then it comes into consciousness and there's a dialogue that goes on there that can be really, really wonderful, really helpful.
Does the buddhi only have knowledge, or does it have erroneous knowledge also?
It can have erroneous knowledge. We don't usually talk about it that way because we're talking about self-knowledge, but really, there is such a thing as mithyajnanam, you know, erroneous knowledge that you act upon.
Yeah.
Like, say if you have... there's a difference if we use two words, prama and jnanam. If we use prama, that means correct knowledge, valid knowledge. If we use this word prama, then the word for just any cognition becomes jnanam. And the cognition can be true or false. Like say the cognition is of a snake when really only a rope is there. But you've experienced the snake. That's what you have experienced. And so you're reacting. Your reaction and your choice of what to do is based upon the snake, which is an erroneous cognition, right? So that something like that can happen, but you still have a determination. You determine it's a snake, and you act upon the snake, even though that's erroneous. Mm-hmm. Our whole life is like that. We're acting as, until we have knowledge, self-knowledge, you're acting off of very highly erroneous conclusions, but those conclusions you're clear and you can respond.
It sounds like a belief, like when you believe something, even if it's wrong, it's like what it's real.
Your buddhi is being contained by that belief. Mm. Yeah, and it's acting, it's making choices and decisions. Based
so
upon
it's not
something.
Objectified at that time, then. You're not.
Well, now when we're objectifying it and even learning about objectifying something, that's when you're being exposed to the teaching. That doesn't have to do with the erroneous knowledge of the buddhi. The teaching, the whole teaching makes you realize that actually the whole samsara, everything that exists within time and space, including your body and mind and sense organs, the buddhi, the ahankara, everything is known, is objectified. Also, the experiences, any experiences that require a vritti, are time-bound. They come and go. Even the ahankara, you're not walking around saying, I am, I'm doing this, I'm that, I'm. You don't have to say these words, you know. It's not necessary, but you're very aware when you do say them, and you're also aware of when you make a decision. Or when an emotion is there. Or when just fluctuating thought flow is there. Mm-hmm. You know? Or when just a perception is there. You're aware of all of these things. They're objectified. There's a subject-object relationship there. This subject-object relationship becomes most meaningful when you find that everything that you had taken to be yourself is now objectified. You know? Everything, every single thing that you took to be your you is objectified. And the you, it's not like, oh no, now I've lost the me. It's that the me, the self that you are, is not bound or tied to any of the upadis. The upadis are tied to the self, but the self is not tied to the upadis, these conditioning adjuncts. You know? And that you recognize that. It's there to be seen. And so now once that viveka, the discrimination is clear, then the buddhi realizing itself is an upadhi,
yeah.
But is sattva, it can turn its attention to the nature of the self, which is the one who is self-luminous and illumining it. You know, and so then the subject, in that instance, the subject-object duality, knower known duality, comes to an end for the moment, because the conscious being, which is the self, because of which the buddhi is known, is being is illumining the vritti, which is turned toward the consciousness. And so that vritti now has no content other than the consciousness, which is illumining it. Usually the buddhi is extrovert. It's, you know, it's either internal or external. You know, it's located inside the body, and it can, as though it's inner to the body, but it also is outer in terms of its experience, is inner and outer. But the self, consciousness, illumines all of that. And so the buddhi has the capacity of, instead of having inner content or outer content, to just turn toward the one that illumines it. And then its content is only of the self. So the self is illumining the content, which is the self. So there's the subject-object duality, that experience is not there at that time.
So that's when you call it objectified then?
I call it objectified as soon as I recognize that it's an object. Right, like when I realize, oh, this body is known to me through my sense organs, through my mind using my sense organs, this body is known to me. And the sense organs are known to me. They're known to me by the mind. The mind uses the sense organs, is aware of the sense organs. So they're objectified. And then I realize the mind also is objectified, because the mind is known. Whatever thoughts are there, or whatever vrittis are there, emotions are there, the doubting mind is there, whatever it is known. The ahankara is known. Everything is known. And so then there's a little space opens up between the subject and the object. So objectifying means things that anything that I have a vritti of is objectified. This is a subject-object relationship. So that opens up space between me and everything I had identified with as me. And now the buddhi can be, in using the prakriyas, be turned toward the very being that is, because of which it is known. And that's how that differentiation between these upadis and the self takes place. And there's different prakriyas that we use to make you see that. We're just using these prakriyas all the time. You don't think, oh, she's using a prakriya. You don't even necessarily know. But that prakriya works in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, to have the buddhi gain the self-knowledge. It's the buddhi that's gaining the self-knowledge.
It's the buddhi that has self-ignorance and the buddhi that gains self-knowledge.
Yeah.
But it's a different kind of self-knowledge, because the object of knowledge, the conscious being, is already totally experienced. It's always there.
Mm-hmm.
It's timeless. Your being is timeless. So the buddhi, in a sense, is already experiencing as though the self, because the self is its being and what illumines it. But the buddhi has taken itself to be that experience, and then taken the body to be that, you know, and the sense organs. I am my body, mind, sense organs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that superimposition is there, mutual superimposition, that needs to be exposed through. Well, I need to be able to differentiate me from the things that are objectifiable.
So is it like the buddhi has taken the mirror for itself? As
I would say that the buddhi has taken Brahman, conscious being, for itself. Because like the clay pot, consciousness is itself. It's not
Can it mistakenly take the mirror?
No, because the mirror is the vritti.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it can reflect, but it doesn't have... You know how I use the example is, if you look in a mirror, the mirror is the reflecting entity, and it kind of reflects yourself. but the self is not in the mirror.
Right.
Well, even though the mirror is there.
Right. I was just thinking the Buddha could be fooled because it's mitya.
Well, the Buddha is fooled. But it's fooled not just because of this chittabhasa or the reflection. It reflects consciousness, but it takes, because of that, it takes itself to be the conscious being.
Right.
And it doesn't take itself to be the chittabhasa or to, as though the chittabhasa is something different. So it takes itself to be the chittabhasa. That would be like saying that's just the natural ignorant condition of the buddhi, of the sattva. I am the conscious being. But the thing is, why that's not completely correct is because just like when you look in a mirror, you see your face in the mirror, but the experience of your face is not in the mirror. The experience of your face is in the face. So it's kind of like that. The buddhi for the chitta and for the vritti, the vritti is made of sattva, the mitya sattva. Mitya sattva reflects consciousness, or consciousness manifests in it. You can say reflects or manifests. These two words, we can juxtapose these two words, pratibimbavada and avichedavada. We talked a little bit about that. But the self experience is not in the vritti. The vritti is in the self experience. And the self experience is the experience of me. The experience of me is not the vritti. The experience of me is the self, the me experience, let me put it like that way. Does it make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You have to kind of reflect on it a little bit. I like the face. The face in the mirror, I think, is a good example to use, because you can see very clearly that when you sit, your seat, the mirror is reflected, but the mirror reflects the face, but it doesn't experience the face.
Where's the buddhi in that?
The buddhi is the mirror.
Oh, the buddhi is the mirror.
And yeah. And the chittabhasa is that reflection.
Okay.
Okay. But that's why Swamiji says dismiss the use of chittabhasa.
Mm.
Because it's confusing, just exactly what Mocheng's question is. That is the obvious kind of confusion, is what is the chittabhasa? What is the experience of the chittabhasa, and what is the experience of the atma? So it's the buddhi experiencing the reflection. It's like saying, is the mirror, I use the face, but we can use the mirror reflecting the sun, you know. Is the mirror that's reflecting the sun and lit up by the sun experiencing the sun?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Say no. The sun is experiencing the sun, not the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
But the mirror reflects the sun.
Mm-hmm.
You see that? Yeah. It doesn't need to be a big deal, but it can be a big deal. It's something, you know. It's something to understand.
Swamiji would so say that we are all destined for moksha because that's our nature, which is very pleasing and relief to the mind. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the one thing that is funny about it is that the infinite minus one is infinite. Right? And so the infinite number of jivas minus one jiva is still an infinite number of jivas. So you're never going to get anywhere in terms of removing all the jivas. But on the other hand, every jiva that exists within this creation is always knocking up against the creation, you know, and learning something every time a knock takes place. You're continually learning and assimilating your experience. And so that continual assimilation of experience will bring you back to yourself. We're always, the whole pursuit of all beings is to get back to yourself, to be yourself. They used to use an example, it's in the Shastra actually, in Prakarna Granthas. Everything wants to get back to its own nature. So one example they use is say if you have a stick and you make it into a bow. So here you have the stick and you make it into a bow and then you tie it. So it holds that bow shape until you cut the cord, and then it goes back. Right away it goes back to its own nature. That's one of those. Another one they use is if you tie a dog up, you know, the dog wants to be free. It wants to be free. It doesn't want to be tied up. So as soon as you let it go, it resumes its own way of being, you know, something like that.
Is there a Sanskrit for those examples that you remember?
I think there may be.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there may be. I don't remember. I'm trying to think of where that is, but they're the same ones used over and over, so. I can't remember where they are. Or Swamiji himself just made up those examples and used them over. But I don't think they've been around for so long that, yeah.
Because the Tibetans have a thing they call cutting through, where they say when you cut through this, basically the mistake.
Yeah.
And you just naturally resolve back into
your natural state. Yeah. And that's what these examples are supposed to be showing.
Mm.
Yeah. Everything wants to get back to its own nature.
You can see that in the dog when he's tied up,
mm-hmm.
when he starts to struggle to get back
mm-hmm.
to himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very visual.
Mm. But my favorite one is the bow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice.
Because you know that bows. Mm. I've heard other stories like, because there's other drishtantas illustrations. Mm. Like if you leave a cow tied up long enough, when you take the rope off, it just still thinks it's tied up.
Mm.
Yeah, and that kind of conflicts with. It's a different type of illustration.
Mm. Did you say something about the term upasam shanti?
Upasam shanti.
I've never heard that before.
That upashanti is there, but upasam shanti, the sum just adds strength to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
It adds what?
Strength.
Oh.
So it means the cessation or the complete extinction of something.
Okay.
So when that seer seeing, that knower known distinction, dyad, is resolved,
mm-hmm.
then at that time, or say resolved so that it's not experienced, at that time, the only thing that is there, what is left out, is me.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's no knower known. I'm actually the self of the knower and the self of the known. Right? There's only one self that illumines the knower and the known. But when that knower known dyad is resolved, all that's left is me. And I think I talked a little bit about two types
mm-hmm.
of resolution of this upashanti. One is the resolution just into the one non-dual self where there is no knower known. The other is the recognition of the knower known dyad as mithya. Mm-hmm. Because with the recognition of mithya is the recognition that only I am here.
Wait, I missed all that. How did that go again?
Oh, no problem, Edward.
So the second one of Satchamitya. So that uses the prakriya of Satchamitya, maybe Karana Karanam.
Yeah. The Karya Karanam cause effect is that resolves into Satyam Mitya.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what does it in that way.
Yeah.
Which causes the cessation of duality.
Well,
and really more the Drik Drisha Viveka.
No, all of the Prakriyas will bring about the cessation of duality.
Mm-hmm. I'm just saying between those two different forms of it, could you divide the prakriyas into, for example, satcha micha and karana karanam as?
No, because karya karana resolves into satcha micha.
Okay.
Because there is no cause effect, because there's no second thing.
Right.
The second thing, the effect is micha.
Okay.
And so in the using of that prakriya, the karana is the cause, the karya is the effect, what you realize is that whatever effect is there is mithya. There is no cause. There is no cause-effect from the standpoint of the self.
Mm-hmm.
There's only the mithya maya,
mm-hmm.
which is not which is in a sense not an effect at all because it has no being. And also the atma, the self, is never modified into that to be an effect of that. And yet we have cause and effect. We say that Brahman is the upadana karana, the material cause of this creation, but it's the vivarta upadana karana. And so then that karana, the cause, is vivarta, means it doesn't go through any modification to become the effect. And so the effect is only mithya.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that's there. There is no second thing for there really to be an effect. But then the second thing is there. So the effect that we experience is mithya.
Right. No, and then I was just interested in the distinction between these two ways of...
resolving.
Yeah.
Any of the prakriyas,
mm-hmm.
in a sense, depending on where you take the prakriya, can resolve into just non-dual Brahman, like mm-hmm. Drisha Viveka.
Yeah.
But in the Drisha Viveka, you're always left with a creation. So you can resolve the Drisha Viveka into just pure Brahman, right? But then the creation is the second thing there, which has to become mithya. But the resolution that akanda akara vritti can be just the resolution of the mind, because that's what you're doing with the Drisha Viveka,
mm-hmm.
is a final resolution just into the atma, which is non-dual. And so that's like a nirvikalpa samadhi or savikalpa samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you recognize there is no subject object, nor no relationship. There is only me, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you can use other drishtantas that highlight the maya, the mityatva of the maya, and the recognition of your non-dual being differentiated from that.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because it's the recognition that maya is mithya, that this creation is mithya, which is the recognition that it has no being, that you are the being. I like clay pot for that.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's a really strong example. Another way of thinking of it is use prakriyas just to, maybe this is more what you're saying, you can use different prakriyas and teaching methodologies just to resolve into the non-dual Brahman where there is no subject-object relationship. There is no nor known. There's just self-evident me. Right? So that's a samadhi, like a samadhi experience or what we call the vritti involved in that is akanda akara vritti.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The akara means the form, the akanda akara vritti, a vritti which is in the form of akanda. No duality, no subject-object relationship. And so when the teaching is taking place, what will happen as the unfoldment comes is there'll be moments of that akanda akara vritti, the mind just resolves into me.
Yeah.
And nothing else is there. There's another resolution that takes place with the teaching is that the mind resolves into Ishvara.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And my being as Ishvara.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see that as myself. So there's different types of resolution there.
Mm-hmm. That prakriya doesn't seem to happen as often as the other.
It happens when Ishvara has been taught.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's just a recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Just a recognition of what's being talked about. Then their mind just sees it sometimes. Mm-hmm. In its own way. I'm not talking about having an infinite the infinite Ishwara Upadhi, all of a sudden comes.
No, you just give everything over to Ishwara.
But yeah, it just happens. Yeah. You just you see everything, whatever you're seeing, you see the whole thing. It's just as Ishwara.
But you're not walking around in an altered state.
Well, we can walk around in altered states, but not with the experience of the infinite Maya Upadhi. That would be very unusual.
Well, not the infinite, but the creation.
The creation is infinite.
There was a discussion last night about the Mahasamadhi and also what happens to the subtle body.
With Mahasamadhi. Mahasamadhi is when somebody who has maturity in self-knowledge, so their self-knowledge is complete, when their body drops, then like anybody else's body, dust to dust, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, it just goes back into the elements. But the subtle body also goes back into the subtle elements, because even before the body drops, your self-identity is the Atma. You know, the Ahankara is still there, but it's mithya. It doesn't replace yourself, your knowledge of yourself. You are you, and you never change. And also, the buddhi revels in that self. You know, and that's as your mind matures and drops off all the raga dveshas, all the likes and dislikes and all of this. The mind becomes more and more naturally in just enjoying being with yourself. And so when a person is mature in their knowledge, then what happens is that when the prarabdha karma is over and the body drops, there's no subtle body there who has any interest whatsoever in moving on. The buddhi itself just resolves into the self, which it is already resolved in. That's already happened. And so there's no coming out of that. There's no one there that says, oh, let's go have an ice cream or something. You know, let's go buy a new car, or let me have a birth where I can be a great tennis player. I used to want to be able to play tennis really well. Didn't happen. I tried. But most of those kind of little desires, they drop off before you die. And there isn't anything there except your mind.
Ishwara.
Ishwara. Just Ishwara and enjoying being with yourself.
So you can notice what it's going to be like at the moment of death then by having this kind of
You do know because you already know yourself. You are yourself and you know yourself. And that self never changes in this life. It never changes in the dream. It never changes in imagination. It never changes from thought to thought. It's not objectifiable. It doesn't exist within time and space. So the you that you are is just the you that you are. It'll always be that. The scenery is going to change. You know, but there comes a time in that there's no reason for the jiva upadhi to be, because there's no ignorance to keep this limited identification going. So you're just Brahman with the Maya Upadhi, which is belongs to Brahman, this as an incidental attribute. So that's who you are. That's who you are right now. But you're also you are Ishwara. You are Brahman, who is Ishwara. You have the Maya Upadhi, but you're identified from beginningless time with this transmigrating jiva. You know, you've been around the block many, many times.
And the habit is just so strong.
Oh yeah, so strong. And
the organization is so strong.
Oh yeah, exactly. Binding ones.
If the habit is still there, then will there be any trouble?
If what?
If the habit is still
what
there.
What habit?
Huh?
What habit?
Identity.
Oh, the identity?
Yeah. If
probably. But a lot of that can burn off, as they say in the Brahma Sutras. A lot of that, some stuff will just burn off. It's called Videya Mukti. Mm-hmm. And when you drop the krama mukti, it's called when you drop the body, there's still a few little things here and there to be worked out that don't require taking another body.
Mm. Yeah.
It's called krama mukti.
Okay. So you don't need to have a clean slate.
Ah, ah.
No, but you can hope, you can have a, you could have a clean slate.
So there's a few little dirty spots there. Get cleaned up and transition.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that must be how it is.
In the case of someone like Krishna, is that the case where there's no ignorance there, but he comes back to help help?
Someone like Krishna or Rama, there's I think there's about 18 avatars. What an avatar is, I like to use this example, because an avatar is really Ishvara taking a form that is generated because of the imbalance of dharma and adharma in the creation. Mm-hmm. So when the imbalance of dharma is so much that the dharmis are not allowed to survive, really, at that time the creation, Ishvara will take a form in order to rectify that situation. And so, as the Shastra says,
yeah.
as the tradition says, so when Ishvara takes a form, there is no prior karma. Like for us, if your this birth is one of kind of a beginningless many, and you are exactly what you are, in that is true to the karmas that caused you to take this particular birth, but for Krishna. Or an avatar, there are no prior karmas that are causing Krishna to take this birth. Rather, it's the collective situation of the creation in terms of dharma adharma that pulls that manifestation forward.
Well, are you expecting that any moment now? I mean, it seems like this is the time.
No.
No, it's not that
bad. It's not that bad, because it's bad, but not that bad.
Not that bad yet.
Because we're still, dharmis are still here. They're allowed to be and to come to mm-hmm. be a counterweight to the adharma.
Ah.
That's the mythology of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I like the, whether or not I believe it. I like the mythology.
I do too, and it works for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I was in the hospital, sometimes I would just start saying Krishna, Krishna, and thinking about Krishna, and I found it very comforting.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I find all of it comforting, and I also. Believe it all, but whether that's true or not, that's different, a little different than Vedanta and self-knowledge.
Mm.
But it's comfortable for me. It's kind of I fit well into that story. Mm. You know?
It's soothing, isn't it?
Mm.
For me it is, not for everybody. It's soothing you know, because that particular myth
and it makes
is real for you. Swamiji, once somebody asked Swamiji, once, this is a long time ago, in 1982, yeah, 1980. We were at Piercy, near Nella, where Nella lives, near Garberville. And we were just leaving, a bunch of us were walking with Swamiji toward his kutir. And somebody asked him, I think it was Chuck Schutz, asked something like, Swamiji, do you believe all the devatas are real? Do you believe in them, like Ganesha? You know, Saraswati and, you know, all of these different devatas. And Swamiji just thought about it for a minute. He said, yes, I do. Then he also said something like, you can't prove something like that is real, but it works for me. It's real for me. You know? I feel that way too. Mm-hmm. It's real for me. But it doesn't have to be real, and it doesn't have to be real for somebody else. It is what it is.
There's a lot of people who, you know, have had experiences with relatives who've passed away, and
yeah,
you know, so
A lot of, yeah, there's been a lot of such experiences. I know. Let's say our prayer. Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Go Brahmane Vyashubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Shobarahitah Brahmana Santu Nirbhayah Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.